Welcome to episode 30 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is April 22nd, 2012. I'm Matthew Furlough, and this is James, my brother, Furlough.
So, was the weather nice down in California today?
You know, I'll be honest with you, James. I spent most of today in Stockton, and it was like 100 degrees by 2 o'clock. So it was awful. It was awful. On the other side, down in like near where I live, San Jose, Cupertino, Silicon Valley area, yes, it was quite nice, but I didn't get to spend most of the day here.
Got it. So it was like mid-80s here. Super nice. My wife and I decided to have lunch outside, kind of like an actual picnic in our backyard.
Yeah.
And afterwards, I decided to take a nap. Have you ever seen it was a Homestar Runner cartoon where oh my gosh, what's his name? Strong Bad like went out to the beach to get a tan and kind of out there for a while.
Yeah.
And then he gets up and like one half of him is completely red and the other half is completely white.
Yes, I do remember that.
That is me right now.
How you look?
yeah, except the funny part is that I had my iPhone and I was listening to tunes while sleeping.
Yeah.
And in my headset. So there is literally a white line going down the side of my stomach, which is where the cord was for the iPod, which is kind of nice. I mean, there's a part of me that's like, from a human art standpoint, very neat. But
you almost have to go out and get burnt again just to even everything out.
Almost. but alas, this is Oregon, and I don't think it's going to last the week.
Right,
so
yeah.
That's what happens. So that was my afternoon. But anyways, I think you were still doing the introductions.
It's true. As we do every week, this week, we'll be talking about technology and the continuing corporate opera, the soap opera that is corporations' dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and my favorite, the technology they're developing. You got a short disclosure for us before we get into the meat of the show?
Yeah, I work for the Hewlett-Packard, and I do not represent the Hewlett-Packard during these podcasts, so I should always say I and never say like we think when referring to Hewlett-Packard. And if I do, I meant to say I. No, really.
Word. Cool. If you want to follow us, you can follow me, my personal Twitter address. Now, just you're Whoa. Special if you're getting this. This is a big deal. It's at Matthew D. Furlough.
I was just reveling in I'm special. And mine is at James Furlough. I guess it's technically personal. It is personable. And personal.
Yeah. Well, my point is, I don't have a secret Twitter account that I tell only people I care about. This is the Twitter account.
This is the Matthew Furlough fire hose.
Exactly. Yeah.
Got it. Matthew D. Furlough fire hose. Sorry.
Exactly. And don't mess people up. You can also follow the show tweet where we talk about technology centric stuff. And that's at Furlough Bros. You can also go to the website where all this information and so much more is kept. I highly recommend it. Or you can go to Facebook or Google Plus or websites of that genre and plus us or like us or tweet us or upvote us or dig us.
Tell all your friends about us.
Right. And you can do that in real life too. I mean, that's the best, really, truly. If you're
I would even take spamming us. I would be okay with that, I think.
Right.
I mean, not like, just for now. I'm in the mood for it. It'd be okay.
Right. I gotcha. So that's how to get in contact with us. Do it. Cool. So pretty exciting article at the beginning of the week. I actually stumbled upon it at the beginning of the week, which is always a good
like
time.
Like literally was stumbled upon?
No, I do not. I haven't stumbled in a long time. I waste all my time on Reddit, so that's how it goes.
Which is similar.
Yeah, it's like the same thing except without the randomness. Anyways, this article, title of the article, Researchers Pioneer Molecular Catalyzer, which I've read a lot of chemists are angry about that word. It's a catalyst.
Sure sounds like catalyzer to me.
I know. But this is PhysOrg, so it's despite the strange word choice, it's still a legitimate source. Basically what they're saying is... You know how fuel cells work, right?
Oh yeah, completely, 100%. All
right. Okay, so I don't need to explain it to you.
Not at all.
Okay, I'm gonna do it for the audience.
But just in
is
case,
right?
Yeah, there's people in the audience who don't know. Perhaps cool. You should give a quick refresher.
Okay, so basically, how fuel cells work is hydrogen and oxygen, hydrogen molecule and oxygen molecule. When they combine together, they create water. Well, that process requires electrons to move from the oxygens to the hydrogens so that they can get your covalent charges going and whatnot.
Naturally.
And you can actually create a system whereby you can get those electrons to take a much longer route, and that longer route can pass through like all sorts of electronics, and so that's how you generate a current powering all your electronics with nothing but hydrogen, oxygen, and water as an output. Well, the big question, it's very efficient, it's very clean, obviously. The problem is where are you going to get all the hydrogen from? Oxygen's, readily available. It's the hydrogen that is the issue. One of the easiest ways to make hydrogen is to put an electrical to an anode and a cathode, a positive and a negative, in a bucket of water, and it'll start to bubble off oxygen and hydrogen.
That sounds a little counterproductive.
Well, the thing is that if you look at it from the perspective of as a battery, it actually is a really great energy storage. The question is doing that efficiently? How can you create hydrogen efficiently so that hydrogen is produced and stored? Right now, we don't have very many ways of doing it efficiently. So one of the things that researchers have been hitting hard is finding what they call a catalyst, which essentially primes the chemicals primes the water molecules to very quickly and efficiently break down, whether it's with electricity or with solar.
So it requires less energy.
Right, with solar energy, yeah. And so they had this huge, huge breakthrough. And this is enormous. The paragraph I'm going to read to you, the molecular catalyzer developed by Professor Sun, yes, his name is Professor Sun, and his team is so fast that it can reach more than 300 turnovers per second, which means how many times it can actually create an activation. The speed with which natural photosynthesis is carried out is between 100 and 400 turnovers per second. So essentially what this thing is it can produce hydrogen at speeds equivalent to photosynthesis. And since this is a process that uses primarily solar energy and doesn't use electrical energy, it's like a photosynthesis equivalent, which is unbelievably huge. It's just like from a physics, biology, chemistry perspective, this is like the holy grail because photosynthesis is the most efficient light to usable chemical energy process that we've ever seen. And so this is actually really exciting. The article doesn't mention too many real weak points in this one. And basically what they're saying is, of course this is always the terrible figure. I'm convinced that it will be possible in 10 years to produce technology based on this type of research. I know. That's sufficiently cheap to compete with carbon-based fuels. Yeah, and it's the only thing is that Department of Energy, Department of Defense, they're dumping money into these guys' research. They're pouring billions and billions. So hopefully that'll accelerate it. But, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, major scientific and engineering breakthroughs are done step by step over long periods of time. So,
yeah,
you know, it is what it is. You wish it could be a year, but that's not realistic. So
that's cool. So basically they'll be able to produce hydrogen cheaper, right? Is that the...
Yeah. Well, and more importantly, they will do... Yeah, hydrogen will be... It'll just use light, so you won't be using any of our limited resources, and it'll be very cheap, and
it'll be more efficient than if you did it using some other way of doing it, which means when you turn it back into water, you actually, I don't want to say create energy, but there's an energy, I don't want to say it like
the efficiency, potential
energy. Yeah, whatever. Cool. I think I'm not saying it, but I know it in my heart.
Right, I got you. But yeah, so there's an efficiency from the amount of energy you capture to the amount of energy that gets, you know, output in your car or your iPhone or your computer,
yeah,
or whatever. And that efficiency will be extraordinarily high, much higher, ooh, than we ever thought possible. Yeah, so very exciting. Can't wait to hear more about this over the future. And, you know, one of my big things, I'm always on the lookout for the next big energy breakthrough, and this one actually seems like a big one. It seems promising, so I'm excited.
Dude, that's awesome.
Yeah, definitely.
That's very cool. So also, like, huge breakthrough. Microsoft has announced their Windows 8 editions. Sorry, that was... That was a joke.
I think it was satirical.
It's not on par. But hey, it's cool. So Microsoft is making some progress. They have, as far as we know, they have limited it down to only 3 different versions of Windows.
It's not fair.
Okay.
I know there's at least 6.
Is there at least six?
Well, tell me about the article.
Well, okay, fine. If you include 32-bit and 64-bit.
What about the x86 architecture for Intel chips versus ARM architecture? Let's hear it.
I'll tell you because obviously you don't know.
All right.
So the three are Windows 8, Windows 8 Pro, and Windows Retweet. I mean, Windows RT.
RT,
which is their ARM-based one, or WOA, Windows what? Of Another. I don't know what WOA. It's their ARM version. So Windows 8, you know, is kind of like that's going to be their official product name, for, you know, their x86. /64 editions, you know, so you know those. And then the Pro is the difference between, like, the consumer version and the Pro version. Let's see here. The consumer version is going to have, you know, Internet Explorer, a task manager, better multi-monitor support, blah, blah, blah. The Pro is designed to help enthusiasts and business technical professionals obtain a broader set of Windows 8 technologies. It includes stuff like encryption, virtualization, PC management, domain connectivity, you know, that kind of stuff. Whereas Windows RT is, like I said, it's their ARM one. And this single edition will only be available pre-installed on PCs and tablets powered by ARM processors, and helps give their lightweight stuff. It will include touch-optimized desktop versions of the new Microsoft Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and OneNote. And, my computer's freaking out. Hold on one second. And thank you for that error message. how do I turn this off? There we go. Done. Speaking of Windows, no. And so it's going to have touch versions of those, and they'll have new apps that are designed for, you know, they're whatever that thing's called. I can't remember right now. They're Metro style. There we go.
Right.
And then they have a cool little table with a bunch of X's saying what ones will and won't have. Like, for example, Windows 8 and Pro, they'll be able to upgrade from Windows 7, whereas the retweet won't be able to. So all of them will have the live tiles and the Windows Store, and they have, like, their main apps and stuff. You know, and then it just kind of... The list goes on for a long time.
I love this list. This is just, from a marketing perspective, it's hilarious. Because it's like, what's the point of a list with X's, right? It's supposed to give you an idea of what their features are, but more specifically, what the differences are. And almost right. All of these have, all three are X'd. Like, it actually makes it difficult to compare and contrast. Because it's like... You know, they've got an entire section of Windows or update Windows Explorer. Like, honestly, why did you have to? Are you trying to suggest that you would not have an updated Windows? Like, really, really? Okay. Windows Update is listed. You're trying to tell me that there was a possibility that Windows would not come with an updater? you're just throwing stuff in here to make the list look long at this point.
What's the difference between an updated Windows Explorer and Enhanced Task Manager? I don't know. I just feel like that's a part of the... Yeah, I know what you're saying. I think I know the difference.
Oh, this is interesting. This is interesting. Windows Media Player won't come for the ARM-based one, the RT. That's fascinating. There will be no Windows Media Player. How are you supposed to play music and like watch movies?
There's an app for that. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
There's no X for it.
Right. That's an interesting move.
They say in their apps section, Mail, Calendar, People, Messaging, Photo, SkyDrive, Reader, Music, Video. There's an app for that.
All right.
Seems good.
Remote desktop? So you can remote desktop, which means you can, with all three, you can see your desktop, but only with Pro can you send a desktop, because only Pro can be the host. Interesting.
Yeah, so anyways, they're only coming out with three. That's it.
That was a good decision.
That's at least what they're saying. Well, it was better. I mean, like, with Vista was bad, and 7 was pretty bad, too, where, I mean, like, do you remember they had, like, those matrices that would tell you, like, what your combinations and options are?
Oh, man. Right. That was terrible. Yeah, and you know.
So, I'm glad to see they're simplifying it, and it totally makes sense to have a consumer. It kind of makes sense, I guess. It makes sense to have a consumer and a professional one, or at least, you know, an IT-friendly one. And then obviously, if they're going to do an ARM version, they got to have a separate one of that. I'm kind of surprised they're calling it Windows RT. I would expect them to call it, like, Windows 8 Touch or something like that.
But that's, you know, that's sort of an Apple thing to do. Give it some clever name. It's a little more Microsoft-ish to be like, give you a name that doesn't actually give you any helpful hints of what it does. But whatever.
Yeah. So it says they're going to tell us even more in the next couple of months, and I don't remember when it's officially coming out, but it's on its way. You know, so.
Cool.
There you go. Windows 8, nice. It's on the way.
It's on the way. I'm excited. October, your birthday.
Get ready. I won't get to play with it for a really long time because HP doesn't update computers that fast. Because we got, like, security stuff, and they got to make sure it works with so many different apps. It literally takes a year for HP to, you know, certify something as good to go.
Which is
pretty crazy.
Yeah, it's a long time. They'll be on a Windows 9 or whatever they're calling it.
No, seriously, HP did not allow people to start installing Windows 7 until Windows 8 was announced.
I believe it. You know, why would you want to be on top of the technology that you're selling to everybody else?
That's not important.
That's all really mean. It actually makes sense. It just, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I'll be honest, dude. In the place where I work, we all of our machines that we build still run on XP. So, you know, it takes some companies a little longer than others.
It's definitely it's a technical security slash got to make sure our programs run issue. I mean, we literally, if HP wanted to and didn't care about that stuff, we could have Windows 8 before everybody else, just because, you know, we make the machines and we know how to make computers that can run it. That's not the issue.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, making sure that it's safe within our environment.
Right. Oh, by the way, I actually had an interesting conversation this weekend and pointed out something that I knew, but was, I don't know if we've talked about it on the show before, but kind of put something together. Have we talked about the .NET platform on the show before? Okay. So, do you know what the .NET platform is?
It's made by Microsoft, and it crashes every once in a while, and when I say okay, it doesn't affect anything.
Yeah, okay. It's so the .NET platform is actually a virtual machine. So Java, the principle of Java is that you write your code and then you don't compile down to the assembly language that runs on the computer. You compile to an assembly that the virtual machine can run. And then they make a different virtual machine for each different type of computer, whether it's Linux or Mac or PC or, you know, an Android phone or whatever. And then, so when you compile it down, it's a universal language. Well,
Flash is similar.
Right. Microsoft actually took that to like a whole new level, which is actually kind of exciting, because what they did was they made a virtual machine, but they set it up so that you could write a compiler that could take pretty much any language and compile down to something that can run on that virtual machine. So essentially what it did was Microsoft has had two languages that they've really pushed for a long time, C# and Visual Basic, and it basically made them the same language. And what's really cool about it is that there's been a real push to like move C++ and Python and Java and other languages that can all, you can write like you were in their language and then compile down, and you can like piece together different languages and stuff with different people's strengths.
That's cool.
And the whole, it's really cool. And the whole reason I bring this up is because the .NET virtual machine runs on Windows Phone 7s, Windows 8, it'll run on RT, it'll run on everything. And so it'll become a universal virtual machine, and you can have any language compile into it. I suddenly realized the goal of Microsoft, and it gets me even more excited about them moving off of the x86 architecture, because basically what they've done is they're getting to the point where you can write any application, and you can write it in this, you know, for a universal virtual machine that will run on tons of different platforms that's really well integrated with the core operating system. And so it's like any questions of, you know, well, you're going to have to write different versions for different computers.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I'm making fun of myself for saying that like 3 weeks ago. And that's just not true. From Microsoft's perspective, Windows Media Player, if it's written in .NET, will run on any platform. The only reason why it won't run on RT is because they're not letting it run on RT. it's a specific reason they're doing it on purpose. It's not a technology issue. So it's encouraging for Windows, because I think that it, you know, a lot of people's concerns are completely unmerited. You know, it's sort of like with Apple, what Apple does, where, you know, people got to get on the bandwagon and use the technology the way they're supposed to. But as long as they do that, you're going to have it's going to be a successful platform. That's not something Microsoft is great at doing, is forcing people to use technology properly. But
well, that's one of the reasons why they're huge, is they are pretty flexible.
Right.
They're flexible within reason.
Right. So we'll see.
I have an article later on about that that we'll finish up the show with.
Cool.
That I think you'll really like.
Nice.
That talks about some of the strengths of Microsoft and, you know, what they did right.
Right.
And those are some of them. It'll be good.
So we'll come back around to that. But
I look forward to it. Stay tuned.
For now, we're going to talk about the impending end of humanity, the singularity, and basically how we got a couple scientists who have now started a project to accelerate us towards the end of the world.
About time.
So scientists are going to build a human brain. Basically, it's a supercomputer that will simulate an entire mind, and the intention is to help fight against brain disease. So that's cool, you know, like...
intention, I'm sure.
Right, yeah, you know, the whole idea of it becoming sentient and you know, building robots and killing all humans, you know, that's possible, but the intention is to help people.
Well, that's because humans are a disease, and the only way to save humans is to take them out.
Right, exactly. So
I think I just combined iRobot with the Matrix there.
Right. Uses for energy. So anyways, what they're doing, it's actually pretty cool. So to simulate the brain and how the brain works, we have like a billion neurons, and each neuron can make like a billion different connections a second. This isn't a perfect analogy. It doesn't work exactly like this, but you can sort of roughly think of each cell as working as like a separate bit on a processor. So to simulate that, essentially what you need is you need to be able to do a billion processes a second, a billion times, which means that you would need like a billion computer chips. So that's what they're doing. This is a 12-year project. Yeah. they're building this huge, huge facility. This is going to be a massive supercomputer capable of doing incredible amounts of computation. They're building it right next to a nuclear facility because...
Wait, how do they know that they're building it correctly?
They don't. Well, they're not building a brain. What they're doing is they're building a supercomputer that will run simulations that they hypothesize will work like a brain. So the whole goal here is that you'll build a computer and then you'll like run a program and you'll say, okay, if we design the brain like this in this simulator, it does this.
So the current problem is any simulation they come up with right now is, I'm going to call it theoretical. They can't actually do the math or the computations
right
like a brain, and so they don't really know what the effects would be of it.
Right. Well, you can take a simple organism, like a really, really, really small, you know, bug that has a few thousand neurons, and you can simulate that very accurately to the extent where you can actually like create a virtual bug that's doing things. I think they've gotten to bigger and bigger, you know, actual.
If they've done it with smaller brains, all right, I'm buying it. Yeah. I would just love to sit in on that little pitch. Here's what we're going to do.
Yeah.
We're going to simulate a human brain to study it. It's going to take 12 years. It's going to take a couple billion dollars. We don't really know what we're going to find, but it's going to be cool. Trust me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it's to me the real difficult question is, you know, how do you make sure it doesn't become sentient? It doesn't become self-aware. You know, which
if it does, you just unplug it. No big deal.
So, yeah.
You should have a pair of loppers right next to the power cord coming out from the nuclear plant. It'll be fine. It's all good. I've seen enough movies. That's how it works.
Right. just need some superhero. Probably Will Smith. He should get ready.
Yeah.
That's
pretty crazy.
Yeah, they're doing it. They're going forward with it. So you know, we'll see what happens.
12 years. What are we? 2012. Okay. 2024.
Yeah, so in 2024, we'll have all of our computers and cars and everything will be running on hydrogen and oxygen. We'll be simulating human brains. That's pretty much all we've talked about so far. So should be pretty exciting. That's all I'm saying.
I wish I understood more about how, like, that works. Because, you know, I read stuff where it's like, when complete, it'll be used to test new drugs, which could dramatically shorten the time required for licensing them to human trials. I'm still kind of like, how do you accurately simulate the brain? I mean, great, you got the computational power equivalent of it. Wonderful, great. But it still requires some sort of software program, I think.
Well, what you do is they'll probably, this is going to be my guess, what they're probably going to do is they're probably going to grow quote-unquote brains. They're going to they're going to think about it from the aspect, from the perspective of the human brain, however it grows, follows a simple set of rules, stimulus feeding it, it interacts a certain way, it creates certain, it has a, you know, some sort of an architecture of DNA and just, you know, chemistry and biology, and then, but then it has, you know, stimulus creating different stuff, and I gotta imagine what they'll do is they'll write a computer program to take exactly, and then whatever that final thing is, that's what they'll run these crazy simulations on. You know, and what they'll do is they'll probably have, you know, an archive of these different brain models that they've come up with using different rules and different whatevers, you know, and so the idea of it becoming, you know, becoming self-aware is ridiculous.
That would be a crazy archive.
Right, exactly. But that's the only way I can think of doing it, because you can't place every cell. You have to work on the idea that a simple set of rules, replicated tons and tons of time, you know, recursively, will create very, very complex systems. You know, it's simple chaos theory, James. So what you're gonna do is you're gonna develop these crazy patterns that you can study in depth. And I gotta imagine that it's not gonna be like, you know, it's going to be helpful, but it's going to be only one tool in your tool belt. What it'll do is it'll allow people, I think what they're hoping will do is it'll allow them to get actually closer to understanding what the simple rule set is that the brain follows to do things, hopefully. And so you can kind of extrapolate that out and get closer and closer. It'll help them design experiments quicker. It won't necessarily give them any answers. It's not like you can pretend like a drug and you can't create a drug and create a simulation and go, well, we know this drug will work because it worked in our simulation. What it'll do, hopefully, is you'll say, if it works the way we, if it follows these rules that we think it follows, it should result in something similar to X, Y, and Z for this percentage of people. And then when you do the drug test on a small group of people and you go, it doesn't do anything like that, you know you got your rules wrong and you got to go back to the drawing board. But if it does what you expected it to do, now all of a sudden you can get really excited because you're like, well, okay, our theory holds true. Now, how valid that is, it's not necessarily rigidly scientific, but, you know, it's better than nothing. It's cool. It's exciting. I think it'll be a big deal.
Yeah, I would agree.
Cool. Huh. So, on the other end of brain stimulation, do you know who Louis C.K. is, James?
I do. Everything, technology is amazing and nobody's happy.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's his quote. I think we just came up with the show title. a couple months back, decided he was gonna try to do a direct to audience sales. Mm-hmm. He's done a bunch of HBO stand up things, and he's made pretty good money. Famous guy, got a lot of recognition, but he decided to pay out of pocket to produce his own show, get people to show up, rent the place, did everything on his own, do all the recording, do all the production, paid for everything himself. And with his final video, he decided, I'm not going to put on a DVD, I'm not going to sell it to HBO, I'm going to sell it to people directly as a digital download for $5. And Paramount, who's worked with him before, an executive just came out and said, Let me read this quote. Perry opened by noting that one has to articulate a problem before seeking to solve it, and he refers to the problem as, quote, content theft. He pointed out that copyright law gives creators the right to monetize their creation, and that even if people like Louis C.K. decided to not do so, that's a choice and not a requirement. And so essentially what he was saying was Louis C.K. decided to not protect his content, therefore not monetizing it, which is funny considering the fact that he made $1 million in 12 days, which he says is more than, he goes, although it's not as much as he's made on other DVDs in total gross sales, it's vastly more than he's ever made, like, personally, after all everybody else got their cut for any given album. So for him, he sits there and goes, yeah, it's the best deal I've ever gotten. From Paramount's perspective, they're like, well, he didn't make as much as he could have, / we didn't make as much as we could have, so he didn't monetize it properly. And the reason I bring all this up is because I think, you know, you're going to see more and more of that from the perspective of as we move into this realm of creators going direct to their audience, you know, using the power of the internet, and you know, we're always talking about the networks and their eventual downfall. But I think that it's interesting when you see, you know, a guy definitely working hard and doing what he thinks is best, and making a bunch of money off of it, and the big corporations, not being very excited about that success.
Yeah, I have a friend. He bought that performance, the $5, to support him when it was going down, because he was like, "Man, I want this to succeed because this is the future."
Right. You know, Aziz Ansari, he's also from Parks and Rec. He's pretty ridiculously funny, and he just did a big push to do the exact same thing that Louis C.K. did. You know, and it's still pretty expensive to have a highly well-produced video made, but they're both making more money than they ever had, and it's so obvious that that's, you know, if you're a big star, why in the world would you work with these corporations that aren't going to make you as much money?
That was an interesting caveat there, right? If you're a big star.
Well, the problem is that, you know, these large organizations, that's where they made most of their money. That was what made them the cat. You know, it was the, you know, or there were, you know, there were two ways for them to make money. One, half of their money came from their big artists, you know, Britney Spears, and it was always an example back in the early 2000s. You'd have your huge pop stars, they'd make tons of money, but then they'd have it was the long tail model of, then you would have a long group of people who made a little money, and them all together made as much money as the few huge artists that made tons of money. Well, if you lose that, it completely destroys the model. You gotta fire everybody. And
well, yeah, but once again, everything. How do you become a big artist? I mean, you don't start out that way. And well, that's where they argue they add a lot of value.
Right. Oh,
they give you opportunities to become huge, and that's part of their payout.
But my point would be, it's like, you got, you know, why Dr. Dre, his big move was Dr. Dre did this in Jay-Z. You know, why is Jay-Z, you know, as wealthy as he is? Because he decided, hey, we're going to go out on a limb, and, you know, the record companies are giving us a support deal, so I'm going to find kids that I think do good work, and we're going to create our own labels and have our own artists. You know, Eminem never would have gotten off the ground if you had to go to one of the big record companies, because from their perspective, you know, is this white kid rapping? They literally said there's no demographic for it. You're not going to do it. It took Dr. Dre to take a leap of faith in him, and, you know, whether like his music or not, he's unbelievably successful. So yeah. It's, you know, and so I think what you're going to see is more and more of that sort of thing, where, you know, of people realizing that they can make a ton of money, and, you know, you could see something where, like, if Louis C.K. and Aziz Ansari, for example, saw a comedian that they really believed in that was having a hard time and didn't want to fight, you know, with the, you know, the production or with the, you know, the bigger production houses, they could fund him, you know, they would get a cut, like, because they'd become their own production house, essentially. But all of a sudden you'd have these smaller groups of people that are going directly to the, you'd go, you know, directly to the end sale. And so even though there would still be middlemen, those groups of middlemen would be much, much smaller and diverse. And you know, I hopefully, I think, hopefully the big production companies will figure that out and change their model to realize that things are changing. And, you know, people can go direct to the end point of sale, you know, much quicker. So, interesting. I thought the attitude was interesting. It's just not even, you know, not a wow, it's something to think about. It's he can't even monetize, but he made tons of money. What are you talking about?
Yeah. Weird. Very weird. So, in other news.
Yeah.
IKEA is coming out with their own HD TV system.
Ooh, it's exciting.
Well, what's cool about it, if you go to the link and watch the video, it's pretty hilarious. Video that they put together. And, you know, it's just cute, fun to watch. But what's interesting about it is they talk about how IKEA, you know, they make cute furniture and cute ensembles for rooms and stuff like that. And what they point out is, like, there's this one section in the house that they've kind of ignored, and it's the entertainment system. And so you have all this cute furniture and this cute layout and stuff like that, and then you have, like, this one place where there's just, like, cords everywhere, and it's horrible.
Right.
They're like, well, we're out to fix it. And so it's this, you know, IKEA-looking set that it's, like, the TV's quasi, like, quote, built into it type of thing.
Yeah.
And so all cables are hidden, and it's got slots for your other machines. It's even got a Blu-ray and a DVD player already built into it. And so the idea is to give it some, you know, IKEA feng shui. But what's really fascinating to me is that what it says to me is that IKEA believes that HDTVs have progressed to a point where they're all the same.
Right.
There's nothing super new and fantastic about it. And now they can come in and say, we're going to add the dressing around it. And we're just going to use, you know, whatever the latest technology is. You don't even care. It doesn't matter. It's an HD television. Don't worry about it. And it's going to look cute and go well with your home and IKEA style furniture.
Right. They think that screen technology has become commodity. I always get this. I always have a hard time.
A commodity.
Yeah, it's become a commodity, and you know, to the point where, yeah, it's now the biggest differentiation is what does it look like on the outside, which is crazy to think about. You know, I think it's a direct commentary on the idea of Apple trying to make their own TV. You know, it's, and which a lot of people recently have been calling into question, which I think is interesting. There's definitely been a shift in the wind of people going, I actually don't think this is going to happen.
Dude, that's what I've been saying.
Right. And I think it's this, you know, I think it's exactly what you know, this is the example that you go to. It's like, you know, why would Apple get into these high-end stuff when the perspective from the rest of the industry is that there's no difference? How do you differentiate, you know, even super high-definition stuff is not really that big of a deal. One of my favorite comments that I read on Reddit about the story was, you know, I am not going to put a TV together with those stupid wood screws. But You know, but yeah, it's an interesting commentary on the state of the industry, and you know, obviously there, you know, some people are still going to go for your real big, you know, I want this and this. And I was talking to somebody about the collapse of Best Buy and or the impending collapse of Best Buy, which I think is a little overstated. I think there are still markets. I think they'll shrink, but I think there's still markets that where they add value, and I think they'll stay around for a while, but. But I, you know, you make the comment of, it's like, well, what do you go there for? You've got, you know, you got your Walmart, you got Target, you got Fry's, you got all these different, you got, Costco, you got all these different major brands that sell all the computers, sell all the TVs, sell all the DVDs. You know, there's, and with TVs, you know, TVs used to be one of Best Buy's, you know, their real big offerings, but everybody sells televisions now. You know, why shouldn't IKEA get into that business? And you know, especially like you said, you know, why shouldn't they design outer cases for TVs? There's nothing special from one to the next. Now, if you could, with a smart TV, really change the pace and do something unique that would be difficult for competitors to catch up with, I think that could be really powerful. I don't know what that would be, but obviously, you know, if you can change the game in such a way that, especially if you can do it at such a scale that it can't be replicated by competitors, then you could really, really make a ton of money, because you'd be the only product that was worth noticing, you know, on a mm-hmm. you know. So I think that's what computer television companies really have to be keeping their eye out for, because it's a bad sign if IKEA can do what you're doing and do it successfully.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, which we'll see.
Yeah.
If they can do it successfully.
Yeah, that's, you know, I think they will. I don't see any reason. I know tons of people that would buy a TV at IKEA without even skipping a beat, you know. Wouldn't think twice about it. But
I would, but that's for totally different reasons. Just because I would think twice before buying a TV.
Right, exactly.
So I also read a really good article on Wednesday. It's really long, by The Atlantic, and it's titled, "The Jig is Up. Time to get past Facebook and invent the new future." And I actually sent it to you, Matthew, earlier this week, because I wanted you to read it. A, because it was long, and I knew you couldn't just skim it right in the last second like I try to do with your articles, and what was B? It's just good, you know, and I'd like to get your thoughts on it.
So the
premise of the article, let me just get this out, okay? Gosh, just relax, relaxe.
Okay.
So the premise, yeah, you're my brother, I could talk to you that way. the premise is, where is the best place to start? That was rhetorical. Don't answer that. is that it said, like, it's saying basically we're here. The future that visionaries imagined in the late 1990s of phones in our pockets and high-speed internet in the air is here. And they talk about how this guy gives an example. The third generation of data and voice communications, the convergence of mobile phones and the internet, high-speed wireless data access, intelligent networks, and pervasive computing will shape how we work, play, shop bills, flirt, keep appointments, conduct wars, keep up with our children, and write poetry in the next century. That was Steve Silberman, who said that for Wired magazine in 1999, 13 years ago, for those of you keeping count. And he must have done it in like January. And basically they're like, yeah, he's right. You know, it's like, I could take a photo of a check and deposit it in my bank account and then turn around and find a new book through a Twitter link and buy it, all while being surveilled. I don't know what that means. By a drone in Afghanistan and keeping track of how many steps I've walked.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it was like decades ago. So like the question was like, now what is the whole point of this article? And it says like decades ago, the answer was build the internet. Woo-hoo. 15 years ago, it was build the web. 5 years ago, the answers might have been build the social network or build the mobile web. And it was around that same time in 2007 that Facebook emerged as a social networking leader. Twitter got known in South by Southwest, and they saw the release of Kindle and the first iPhone. There have been a lot of new phones since then and plenty of e-readers that look like the Kindle with countless social networks that look like Facebook and Twitter. And their basic thing is like, okay, done that. Let's check it off the list. It happened. You know, and they even go as far as to say other things like Tumblr and Instagram and Pinterest. Yeah, these are these new exciting things. You know, and even we got the new iPad, or even now we have the iPad. But let's be honest here. Tumblr, Instagram, and Pinterest are like different versions of things that we already have. And the iPad is nothing more than a bigger iPhone that was made back in 2007. And so it's like it's been 5 years. Let's move on. let's quit figuring out ways to let people like your pages and take photos. Let's try to like, what's the actual new big best thing? And then I thought it was interesting. They kind of go on this like this rant, which was talking about company ideas and talking about the difference between like a free and a paid service and how, you know, people go, it's got to be free because it's the internet. But it's like, and which is like, okay, I guess. Like with free, or I should say like with paid stuff, if your app is stagnant, and in other words, you have like the same number or your software is stagnant, like there's you have the same number of users, you're still making money because you're
paid. Right.
If you're growing, you're making more money. And if your paid software is exploding, you're making lots of money. And then they compare that with free. If you're stagnant, you're losing money.
Yeah.
If you're growing, you're losing more money. If you're exploding, you're losing lots of money.
Right.
I love that because it's like you think about Instagram, which was currently bought for $1 billion and is growing like gangbusters, have zero revenue model. They have the losing lots of money problem right now.
Right. Well, no, they don't anymore. Yeah.
Mark Zuckerberg has that problem.
Right, exactly. Somehow I have a weird sensation that Facebook will figure out how to make money off of them, mostly because, you know, they're making tons of money right now.
I think they won't make any direct money, but they'll keep user tie-ins, and when people visit the website, they'll have ads that
Well, it'll improve the overall system, and the overall system will make more money because it's more improved. I mean, it's, you know.
Yeah, that's fair, I guess. And then, I mean, and he, oh boy, I don't even know. I should look this up. Let's see. It's a good dude. It's a dude, even though his name is Alexis. The pictures of a dude.
All right.
So he says, you know, maybe there's hardware stuff in there, like, you know, an iPhone 5 has some crazy surprises, probably won't. Maybe it's an interface thing. Who knows? And then he just finishes up with, the truth is, though, I'm a journalist, not an entrepreneur. So he's like, mostly my contribution is ranting about it. Your contribution is to fix it. So nice. Let's say, all right, social networking and mobile, or at least in its current form, you know, check the box, done. What's next?
So this is an interesting thing. So this is something that we've talked about a lot. Now, number one, I think the question of what's next is the most exciting question that could possibly be asked. But before I get to answering that question, I want to address the idea of social media boxes been checked off. Because, you know, I think the obvious thing, people are starting to become comfortable with the idea that Facebook is going to be you know, the big dogs for the next 5 years. There's no impending wave of doom, whereas I think when MySpace, you know, I think with MySpace there was still a sense of we're still young, there's not a huge, there's still billions of people that we can go and get to use our service and make a real big difference. Well, there's not really billions of people that you can do that with anymore from Facebook's perspective. So if their goal is just to become the biggest network, they're getting pretty good at that. But there's still things that they need to do. And I think what you're going to see is you're going to see the the consolidation of companies, and the expansion of it. It's like, you know, fast food, you know, when fast food became like, okay, this is the big deal, this is where we're going in America, they still had tons of growth and they still had tons of, you know, of things that would happen, companies that would come and go, you know, and even though McDonald's was clearly the winner, it was still worth the time to, you know, get into the game if you're like, I don't know, a Subway sandwich shop that was going to make sandwiches for $5 and make it to order as people ask for it. You know, they're doing all right right now, you know, so it's, yeah. I guess what my point is that, you know, it's, the game's not over, but I agree with him that everything from here on out is iterative improvements. You don't have any revolutionary changes. Social media, we kind of understand what that is. And I guess what you're seeing is that I think he was taking it from a very short-term, exciting perspective of Twitter gets announced, you know, Facebook hits the scene, MySpace is falling and Facebook is rising, and but MySpace was like getting everybody excited and people were jumping on and using it for the first time, and I think it was very easy to see that quote unquote what's next was social media at that time. But the truth was 5 years ago, 7 years ago, 10 years ago, social media wasn't what next. It was what is. It just took 10 years for it to mature to the point where the vast improvements have slowed down a lot. You know, it's like you know, people are, you know, people got really kind of spoiled with Apple over a few year period because they kept bringing out new hardware, bringing out new, you know, bring out the iPhone 4, you know, the iPhone 3G, bring out, you know, your Storms and your Androids and you know, have all these new platforms. Well, those platforms are all kind of have settled and matured a lot in just the last few.
Which is crazy to think.
Right. And so then they brought out the iPad. They're like, oh my gosh. And now, you know, Windows 8 Metro is coming out. And it's like, it's so exciting because, you know, the tablet market is doing what the iPhone market did before it and what the MP3 market did before it. And, you know, and the thing is that those are so short term that by the time you realize that the revolution is happening, the main players have already been picked. And so the question that I would ask, you know, what I think is interesting is something is happening right now. There's something going on that is really exciting that nobody's looking at, and in the next year or two, they're finally going to get the attention that they deserve, and all of a sudden that is going to be, quote, the next big thing, when the reality of it is that that's the thing that's been happening and that's the thing that's going to be coming. So, and then beyond that, you have, like, what is actually the next big thing? What are the things that people are just starting to scratch the surface of imagining? I think that next phase, the long term, what does come in 10, 20 years, that is all the you know, that's where you get your microprocessors, where everything is a microprocessor. Your car is a computer. Your window is a computer. Your countertop is a computer. Your desk at work is a computer. You know, and when I say computer, I don't mean a Windows desktop or an iOS system. I mean little microprocessors that keep track of data and control everything dynamically and have Wi-Fi antennas and connect, you know, network, you know, the network of everything. You know, something I know that you used to dream about was the idea of being able to Google, where are my car keys?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's the sort of thing that's coming 10, 20 years down the road. And the reason why that one's so long term is because that's not just a software issue. That's a hardware issue.
The thought that I had was the, you know, a space, you know, thinking about that, okay, what is actually next? I went, well, yeah, okay, mobile, sure, perhaps, but location is definitely just in its baby infancy right now.
Right.
I mean, it's like, it's so small. And you think about like the Google goggles that we talked about last week.
Right.
Maybe 2 weeks ago. I don't remember now. you know, that was like dependent on pinpoint accurate location and having an awareness of what was going on around that location. And there's nothing like that exists right now. I mean, there's there's just the glimmers of it right now. But that is it. And, you know, so it's like, no, that's definitely a place that, and that whole, like, that physical search of where are my car keys, and it's that having that awareness of the surroundings doesn't exist yet. And,
right.
And I definitely think that's going to be a huge thing. You know, it's funny. I also think, like, you know, there's actually a financial revolution going on right now, or disruption, whatever. You think about, like, what Mint is making possible in order to track your finances and manage your financial life. That's a huge, big flipping deal.
Right.
Yeah. Be able to do online banking, take a picture of your check, and have it automatically deposited. Whoa. Yeah,
and I don't think that sort of thing is done. You know, that the really exciting stuff, I don't think that's a settled technology at all. You know, there's still innovation that's going to come to that are going to seem huge.
Yeah, and clearly, I mean, you kind of touched on it, like transportation. That's, you know, and that's right in there with location services too. You know, that's going to be, I don't know, I feel like it's...
Cars that drive themselves are just like, they're right on the precipice. I mean, you know...
Because I read an article that was like, why are we pressing for that? Can we, what's after driving? Like, what comes after that, really?
Oh, come on.
For me, it's teleportation. It's video conferencing is actually what I've... It's more lifelike video conferencing.
Okay.
Because now the thing with the problem... So this is what I've noticed, and this is coming from a guy who works from home all the time. So I don't get day-to-day interaction with my coworkers. But I have worked in an office before with coworkers, and there's one huge difference, and it is... what I would call serendipitous conversations. You know, just the random thing that you say. The
serendipity.
Random...
What a great movie. Sorry.
I hate that movie with a passion. Don't get me distracted because it will happen.
I'm sorry.
But I think that there's actual value in that to be able to ask a real quick question and go, hey, right. Check this out, or what do you think about this, or hey, dude, what's the score on that baseball game, whatever. Whereas when you're not with a person, you're not going to do those. You're only going to contact them if you have like a purpose to contact them, or you have a, you know, preformed question. You know, there are no such things as serendipitous conversations. Oh, I accidentally dialed your phone. How you doing, man? What you up to? You know, that doesn't happen. Well, not except for butt dials. That doesn't happen. And with smartphones, that's becoming more difficult to do. Okay, the point is that there is, until like communication can reach, like, can get that serendipitous piece to it, I don't think it'll ever be as good as face-to-face communication. So, I mean, I've literally toyed around with the idea that what if, like, let's say with our mom and dad, we just left our video conference running, you know, like had a Skype chat or whatever, and just
We've done Christmas like that a couple times, and I think that's you kind of get that feeling of you get the feeling that you're coexisting with the other person. You're having this, even though you're not actively communicating, you're going through everything and you're doing, you know, and you know, it's not quite the same, but I've definitely noticed that to me, that's the real beauty of the video conferencing, is that sort of omnipresent, you know, the person's there in the other side of the room with you.
Almost like you have to wait until after like that first 20 minutes to a half hour of the conversation to when people start getting up and moving around and doing things. And HP tried to do this with their Halo project, and ultimately just in a business setting, it maybe didn't make a whole lot of sense. And I don't think it's affordable on a consumer level, but imagine if we're talking about what's next, right? I could imagine one day where you have a wall that's like a video wall, and I see like our parents' entire living room.
Yeah.
And if they're watching television, and I'm sure there'd be copyright issues with this, so whatever, you know, like I could see what they're watching. And I could hear it running in the background. And if someone got up and walked around, I could see it too. And they could see me. And you got enough cameras where it all works and the sound works well enough. But you could see that in an office environment too. That could be very interesting. And you just like walk up to the wall and talk to someone. That'd be weird. But you know, whatever. I'm just dreaming because I work all alone all the time. It's not that sad, actually. I love it. That would be weird, because then I'd actually have to, like, get dressed and take a shower. It's bad. But anyway,
no, dude, you could be like a Tupac hologram. Just do like,
yeah,
do yourself as like a showered, well dressed CGI avatar of yourself. That would be awesome. So that would actually be really cool. That's a really good idea. I'm gonna patent that. So the other thing I wanted to mention about this is that you know, for really exciting. Let me rephrase that. Are you done talking about that?
Sure.
Okay. Because I'm gonna turn the corner a little bit, and bring it back to things that I dream about. In that, for me, it's like, let's go back 100 years, 150 years. You sewed everything by hand, and there was this really exciting innovation, which was the sewing machine that did simple stitches for you. And at first, that was only available in production, manufacturing. A big business owned these things, and then that slowly moved to be a consumer-grade product that you could have in your home to do your own sewing projects. You see, right, the same thing with cars. Vehicles became, at first, only the rich people had them, or, companies that were doing stuff with them, building tractors, whatever. It wasn't until Henry Ford came along with, a consumer-grade product that people could buy. And you see the same thing with computer technology, where you have a industrial product, a thing that took rooms and tons of power and but was great for something, and then as it got smaller and smaller, it became a consumer grade product. The personal computer. And so for me, I think right now, automated manufacturing and roboticism within the manufacturing realm is exploding. And and they can't get enough people to engineers to be doing those jobs, which means we're going to start training more engineers to do those jobs. Cool. I mean, we're going to pay people more. More money is going to be pushed into that field because it improves manufacturing. It improves profitability. It's in a lot of ways, it's the only way to keep up with growing population sizes, stuff like that, more sophisticated equipment. All those things, but the end result will be you'll have this glut of engineers that are building incredible computers, incredible robots, doing all sorts of crazy innovation there, and you'll have a ton of engineers who know how to do it. All of a sudden, that's when you'll start to see some serious robotic innovations in the house on a consumer grade.
That's cool.
And to me, it's like, that's if it follows at all the what we've seen over the last 200 years of humanity, of that's the innovation cycle following that, that's what you're going to see. That's when robotics comes in. So, you're talking about the next big thing. You got to look, you got to know where to look. And like you say, one of the things you got to look for is what are people doing and what would make their, make their lives better. Well, people aren't hanging out as so much, but that has a disadvantage. How do you adjust for that? Likewise, what do we see? You know, more sophisticated buildings. You see more sophisticated work areas where more technology is getting poured into these things to be more intelligent, to save money for these companies, and improve the environment that they're working in, not just, plants and trees, but, sound and light and how people feel and, all sorts of things, whether it's climate control or whatever. On top of automated tasks being done without people, or rather with people just overseeing them, I think that's the direction for me. I mean, that's where it gets huge. And I think we're obviously going that way. And you're seeing Google pioneer technology for cars that, drive themselves. Well, the next obvious step is semis that drive themselves because they can afford that large-scale investment because it makes sense for them. You save money, you make money, you it's easier on the people who are, sitting in the car, in the truck, making sure it's driving.
Safer. All that stuff, yeah.
Yeah. And then, that's where you put all those big investments because it's financially worth it. And then slowly that becomes a consumer-grade product to the point where,
Oh, I hope not.
Your Honda Civics. What do you mean you hope not?
I want it to be consumer grade like right away.
I know. I don't want to wait. Well, that's the one interesting thing about what Google is doing, because they are starting on, they're integrating it into consumer grade vehicles. And so that's pretty crazy, because that's not what
you. Well, that's because they started with the Prius, because they're all a bunch of green hippies over there in Google. Please hire me, by the way. I'm kidding. I love my job. It's okay.
Yeah. HP is great. HP is awesome.
Yeah,
just to verify that. We'll edit that out in post. Yeah. So for me, it's like that's where the real that's where you got to be looking. You got to be paying attention to that.
Okay.
So I guess the jig is up is an interesting comment. Not so much on the fact that there's no more innovation in America, or there's some sort of a we don't have any dreams for the future, because that's just not true. I think what is really something you have to pay attention to is, or about that article, is the fact that mobile computing and where you have one device that centralizes all your computing and social networking have matured to a large degree. But I think mobile computing is going to get to the point where everything has a computer and everything can communicate with each other wirelessly. On social, I don't know where social goes, except for the fact that, obviously there are all these services and sort of, how these new services like Pinterest and Instagram and Foursquare all kind of fit into the social network. That still hasn't been fully decided. It's just the networks have been pretty well established. Now you got to figure out how everything else fits in. And I think that's, and to me that's exciting. So yeah, that's my thoughts.
Good thoughts.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, I think it's coming.
Yeah.
We just gotta wait. Be patient. So, speaking of waiting, this summer, gotta wait until this summer. There will be 32 sports that will be streamed at the London 2012 Olympics. So this is cool. NBC will be streaming all 32. Well, not all. Yeah, we'll stream all 32 sports live on the internet.
Whoa.
Even before the time-delayed television broadcast.
Whoa.
Not only are they going to live stream the live content, but they'll also provide users with access to a vast catalog of archived material.
Nice. So you can see, like, old Olympics?
Yes.
That's cool.
And, let's see, and the only restriction will be on events that will feature prominently in the evening's broadcast, which will be locked down after the stream until sometime after the So not only are they going to stream everything live, but they'll also archive it almost immediately. So let's say you miss
nice.
It, or there's two events that you want to watch, you're like, oh, I gotta choose. No, you don't. You just pick one and then watch the other one.
Dude, I'll be totally honest. Last Olympics, I was really excited about it, and I didn't get to watch very much of it.
It was horrible.
That killed me.
Well, but their online experience was, it was bad.
And dude, so I didn't even try.
It was,
that was that bad.
I tried it a couple times, and I was just like, this is bad. And so it said, unlike NBC's Olympic streams in the past, which used Microsoft's Silverlight technology, the London 2012 coverage will be powered by YouTube.
Nice. Oh, that's gotta be. Of course. That's gotta kill
the
Microsoft.
The content will still only be available on NBC's site, probably because they can get the ads on the side. And in the UK, the BBC will have 24 HD Olympic streams available. And so it'll be about 2,500 hours of live coverage when it's all
done. Holy cow.
And then it says, whatever's on schedule that day, if cameras are on it, we will stream it.
Nice.
And, this is awesome, if I may say. Oh. And because this is good for someone like me who doesn't own a television, it's awesome.
But it's just awesome on so many levels, because it's like you get to watch the stuff. I'll still get to wake up early with Jesse, and we'll watch stuff live, because that's always fun to hoop and holler.
Right.
That stuff when it's 5 in the morning or 4 in the morning for that matter. Yeah. We did that with the World Cup, and when it was in South Africa, and it was awesome. Nice. And which was also streamed, by the way, on ESPN3, The Trace.
The Ocho.
Yeah. And Dodgeball, for those of you who aren't home. What? But I think it's cool that NBC is finally starting to embrace this streaming and hopefully doing it right. I mean, we'll see.
Yeah.
In past years, they tried to play games with it, and it's like, oh, we'll do certain things, and it just has not been an excellent experience. So I'm hoping that with Google's help, it will be a good experience.
It sounds like somebody finally sat down and talked people into the idea of, let's just try this 1 year to just give people everything they want whenever they want it, and because it's not our servers, we don't have to worry about it. You know, it's Google's going to power it. We know they can handle this kind of data distribution. So you know, we should be good. You know, and it's, I think what it is
well, and I think they'll still be able to put like their commercials in the screen.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, expectation.
I'm sure they've worked out some pretty sweet deals with Google, you know, and I'm sure Google is A-okay with it, you know, you know, and not to mention the fact that, you know, they'll still have the evening broadcast, which I think a lot of people will see. You know, it's like, obviously, like, the opening games will, or not the opening ceremonies will probably, they'll wait, and, you know, they'll live broadcast that no matter what, but, yeah.
Well, and you I think it's like they realize, you know, we're going to make a ton of money off the live broadcast, off the cable broadcast. So, you know, cool, whatever. This is just added on top of it. And I think they have found that there's something to be said about buzz. And
right.
Actually, they said this quote here. They said that streaming could increase viewing figures of the time-delayed broadcast, explaining that anytime you have a great event that happens before it shows on the air, it increases ratings and generates buzz.
Right.
So when something amazing happens, you know, especially if YouTube does a good job of not, you know, letting people, what do I want to say, like, you know, create the snippets and it goes, you know, viral right. on YouTube.
That's a really good point, because I didn't even think about that. But yeah, if they don't archive immediately what's going to be live broadcast.
Well, I guess they are going to. But the things that are going to be prominently displayed, they won't.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. You'll get the live. So it's like, for example, when Usain Bolt last year, you know, the guy who like had run the 100-meter dash once, and he just showed up and qualified, and everybody was like, okay, yeah, we'll let him run, and then crushed the world record. You know, that sort of thing. The people who were at work or awake at the time would see that and go like, oh my gosh, you know, that would hit Twitter, that would hit Facebook, that would hit everything. People would be like talking about it. You'd go to YouTube and you're like, I have to wait until they show it on NBC tonight. Oh my gosh, I have to watch NBC tonight. And you know,
totally.
And oh yeah. And it's, what's so exciting about this for me is that for me, they never show the sports that I love on the evening broadcast. The only sports that they ever show, are,
dude, which sports do you love? I don't even know.
Oh, dude! I am all about the weightlifting, and I am all about the karate, which they'll sometimes show during the day. But like, oh, they're awesome. They're so cool. And I've always wanted to get into like the triathlon. What's the ones, the one where they like go shooting and like horseback riding and like it was designed
stuff. Or?
Yeah. It just seems crazy. It's like a ridiculous series of athletic events where you're like, where did they come up with this? But it, you know, turns out it's like, this is what you would have to do if you were like a scout, you know, and back during like the Revolutionary War days. And so they have an athletic sport for that.
Yeah. By the way, the pot is sleeping in the bedroom.
Yeah, I saw that, but I appreciate the heads up.
No problem.
The pot is... So to me, that I can't wait to see those ones. And you know, obviously, there's like, you know, there's no curling this year, so can't get too excited about that. Oh, you know what they're doing this year? This is the first year where they're doing what's that one with the little blue ball in the room with the paddles? What's it called? That sport
racquetball?
Racquetball. At first year, racquetball is an Olympic sport. How exciting is that? You'll get to watch racquetball. I can't wait. I'm so excited.
Intense.
I know. They're going to be so awesome to watch, you know, with their hand paddles and stuff running up the walls. Oh, man. It's going to be good. Get excited.
I am. And I'll be watching it.
I'm so glad to hear that, because that was just going to take all the enthusiasm out of me if I couldn't, you know, watch the events on during my breaks or, you know, watch them live and stuff. And because I, like, never sit in front of a TV, pretty much I'm, like, you know, even though I have TVs around me, I wouldn't have gotten to actually watch it. So that's right. Cool. Anyways. So this is... actually, we talked about this a little bit on Wednesday when nobody was listening, so we decided we wanted to talk about it again. So this is an interesting question. So this is my transition. So U2 has all this data that they hold on to, and it's like they'll be storing all the Olympics data. Well, where does that data go after a company collapses? And I think what's interesting is that we've never seen this point, especially with the advent of cloud computing, this sort of question of, okay, I'm going to put all my data somewhere. You know, and they always say, you know, have multiple backups. You know, have your backup on your personal computer, have your backup in the cloud, have your backup. But comes a point where it's impossible to back up that data because it just becomes too massive, or, you know, it becomes too disjointed. And you kind of rely on that service to just be around and doing what it's doing. And that's an unreal expectation. And one of the things that I think is the impending problems we're going to see is obviously, you know, RIM is in a spiral right now. And there's a real risk that by the end of the year, they'll need to be bought out by somebody. But they've got their BlackBerry Messenger service that they've really been pushing, propping up, and it's all of your messages and all your tweets and all your texts and everything are secure and stored, and you know it has cross-platform support. It's really awesome, and the whole thing is really useful for like the SEC, you know, to make sure that the Securities and Exchange Commission, you know, the guys who overlook Wall Street, you know, all your different, you know, major country governments, whether it be Saudi Arabia or, you know, America or whatever, you know, wherever, Canada, you know, where, you know, major political or major governmental organizations leverage that system for, you know, archiving, essentially. What happens when RIM's gone? Where does that data go? You know, it's not the sort of thing that you can just lose that data.
No, not really.
You know, and so there wasn't an article on this. This is just a random thought that I think is we'll have to keep an eye out for. I must have read it in an article or something. If I had read it in an article, I would have added it. So I must have heard it on the radio or something. But anyways, there was a mention of the idea that RIM might try to spin off the BlackBerry Messenger service, as it's one of the few things that they feel is actually valuable. They might try to sell to somebody, which means it would go to a company that is strong, that has, you know, a lot of sturdiness to it, and, you know, financially can guarantee that data is going to be safe, which is one way to take care of the issue. But, you know, it's like, what happens if that doesn't happen? Or, you know, if, even as a, you know, bigger question, what happens if you know, Google suddenly, you know, Oracle wins this lawsuit against them and says, you can't make Android anymore, and you have to give us your search engine, you know, for damages. And what, you know, all of a sudden Gmail, you know, what happens if Google stumbles, and what happens to all your Gmail emails where, you know, you got these huge corporations that, not huge corporations, but small businesses that are really leveraging that, and they can't have that data just go up in smokes. And I think it'll be interesting, especially for stuff where there's a lot of government tie-in. You know, if the question becomes, you know, okay, nobody wants the BlackBerry Messenger service. People would negotiate themselves out of it because they don't want the burden of that. Does there come a point where the government steps in and says, okay, we'll buy it? Which is, you know, terrifying on a number of different levels.
Well, I mean, theoretically they could and say we're going to run it for ourselves. And
right.
If we have other customers, fine, but we're not looking for any. Or
right.
I could see that.
I could see them do what they did with the bank bailouts, where they make it so that they take away the financial burden for a private company to own and manage the service. But I don't know. It's going to be fascinating. I'm really excited to see what happens with BlackBerry Messenger, because that matters so deeply to the government. It's something I think that there's so much oversight over that system already. You know, they can't just let that go anywhere. That needs to be managed and oversaw. And I wonder, you know, there's a part of me that wonders if it'll be so boring that nobody will write an article about it.
I doubt it.
You know, but there's a chance that we just won't even hear about it.
Come on, people love dying companies, and
that's true. Well, but I mean, that's
part of the story.
That's true. But I hope we get to hear about it. I hope we find out, because you know, that's a big question. You know, companies don't last forever, and we want our data to last forever. So it's something we're going to have to, as a society, as companies, figure out how that's dealt with before I think we can really invest ourselves, you know, into this, like, just, you know, I know you and I kind of, you know, jump into it a little bit heads first, you know, kind of, you know, well, we'll see what happens. How bad can it be? but it will be really fascinating to see in the next couple of years how that sort of thing is dealt with.
Yeah.
That'll be good. I'm excited. Speaking of,
I love it. Excited, yeah, for a company to fail.
Right. I can't wait. So this actually is kind of tied in conveniently. So, you know, the Oracle Google trial is going on right now. We talked about it last week. The idea that Google ripped off Java's APIs. It's essentially a Java virtual machine, and it's almost impossible to say that that's not the case. Google obviously is trying to say that because it's worth a tremendous amount of money to say that. But the question that people think really needs to be answered is whether or not you can copyright APIs or not, and, you know, stuff like that. But that's besides the point, because the CEO, Larry, right?
Mm-hmm.
Larry Page. He basically said he was in there testifying, and he basically said that, you know, Android is important to us. You know, we like Android, but it's not critical. Like, we don't actually need it. Which I'm not exactly sure why he said that.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out, like, how does that fit in the context of
right?
Under questioning from Oracle's lawyer, he said it was important but not critical.
Right.
They must be trying to get him to say, like, you thought you were forced into doing it or something like that.
Right.
Because, yeah, it was critical. I don't know.
Yeah. And, yeah. So, but what's interesting about that, and why this, I think, matters to the discussion we were just having, was what happens if, I actually think that one of the reasons they say that is because one of the things Oracle wants is a licensing fee for every Android phone that's sold. And the figure that I just heard today was like $5 to $7, which would essentially, they think, would threaten the idea of it being a free, continuing to be free software, that companies would start to have to pay per phone. Now, that actually, to me, that doesn't seem like a lot, you know, because that essentially, you know, if every phone went up and cost $10 and the manufacturers paid the licensing fee, that doesn't sound horrible. But that number could get bigger. And I wonder if that was sort of a thing of saying, look, we can survive without Android. If you push this too far, and because I personally think that what's going to happen is even if the judge settles the trial, I think Google is, you know, or whoever loses is going to appeal to the next court up. And I think eventually what will happen is it will be settled out of court. But they're just trying to sense legally who has the upper hand. In that case, who will get the better deal. And so I think to a large extent, Google is still trying to send the message of, if you push this too far, you'll lose everything. You won't get anything. There's no good that comes to you because we're willing to die on this, or we're willing to give up and walk away. So don't get too crazy. I think that that's what they're trying to say to Oracle. Part of it, but it's an interesting perspective because it's like, man, could you imagine if Google just stepped off of Android later this year? I guess, well, that was fun. Well, that was a cool experiment. What else are we doing?
They do tend to quit services or, you know, cancel them, so I can
see.
I would be shocked if they did that, but well, yeah. At the very least, manufacturers could continue to use the software that was already built, so it's not like it would disappear.
Right, but you know, it would change everything. I think people would instantly stop buying the phone. But like I said, I don't think that that's why they said it. I actually do think that they are very much still trying to position themselves for the eventual settlement. That will happen outside of court.
That makes sense.
You know, because it just doesn't. It seems ridiculous to me that, you know, whoever, there's so much money sitting on the table. You know, you can't. You know, for whoever wins, I don't think that, you know, some judge is gonna put down his gavel and it's gonna end there. I think that this one still has quite a few wrinkles before we get to the end of it, but
you know,
Google's really trying to get to the point where I think they're saying, look, we didn't use the free portion of it, we built our own virtual machine. And
that's kind of weird. Why do you pull in the CEOs for that kind of conversation? I don't know why. It seems like a very technical argument. Show us your code. Let's see if it matches up. Either it does or it doesn't. It seems very black and white, pretty straightforward, but maybe not. I don't know.
Well,
I'm not a lawyer.
I think one of the problems is that Google, you know, technically, what Google is arguing is that the part of Java that they used were phrases in the, you know, these are chunks of codes that you can use to do something, but we don't have the Java virtual machine. We just have a virtual machine that understands Java, which is a little bit different. And the question is it different enough for them to argue that, you know, that they don't owe Oracle anything? And I personally think that. So there's a lot of people that are saying that this isn't actually about Google trying to prove that they didn't use Java anymore. They're more or less, you know, they're not arguing vehemently that they didn't use Java. What they're arguing now is the part that we used is okay because it's not really something you can copyright. I don't know. It's crazy. I'm excited to see what the end result is on all of this because I think it'll, you know, it could open the floodgates on Java too. You know, that would be interesting to see if this totally backfires on Oracle, you know, because they – basically they've been told, you know, basically if Google wins outright and there's no settlement at all, then what Google has basically proven is that you can create a virtual machine that can compile Java code, and there's nothing that Oracle can do to stop you. And all of a sudden, you know, you can build platforms without the licensing fee.
Wow.
You know, which would crush, you know, which would crush Java as a platform.
Which is why I would be shocked if that happens.
Right, and that's what Oracle's fighting against. You know, so I think that's part of the reason why the CEOs are there, though, is because the real discussion that they're having, you know, for the judge is, what's the real world implications of the decision I make? You know, and what does it mean for these different technologies? What can I do that will be equitable to both companies, who have clearly put a lot of time and effort and innovation into different aspects of it? You know, but you know, so it's a fascinating conversation. I think it's a lot more interesting than the conversations that are going on about Google versus Apple, to be totally honest. it's cool.
Well, I'm glad you find them fascinating.
Yeah, okay. Was that your sign that I should move on? other things, Verizon on Thursday. This will be a big deal next week when Apple has their earnings call. Verizon basically said this past week that sales of the iPhone have dropped precipitously. They're down 25% from the quarter before.
Shocker!
I know.
That means nothing.
They announced the phone coming into the Christmas season. They sold like crazy because the new iPhone came late. There were a ton of people that were just biting, you know, chomping at the bit to get to upgrade, and then you go right into the Christmas season. You know, it's you know, no wonder they sold tons of them. But I think it will be interesting to see. You know, the stock plummeted because of that announcement. But I think it'll rebound come Monday when they make their announcements and they beat expectations. But we'll see. That's always a good question. So the other thing that seemed to get a lot of attention this week, and I think it's because Apple not so slyly, or something happened where people basically figured out that we know what the new iPhone 5 with the new shell design is going to be, what the big move is, and it's to liquid metal. Everybody was talking about it this week and acting like, oh, we heard rumors, you know, but usually when like there's a real torrent of people talking about it, it's because they either get a really, really reliable source coming out of China or a couple of sources out of China, or it's an internal leak by Apple. So I can't remember. Have we ever talked about liquid metal on the show before?
No.
No, okay.
Mercury is the only liquid metal I know of.
So liquid metal is a company and just the name of a product. It's a amorphous alloy made up of all sorts of different crazy molecules and stuff. Let me see. I had the list somewhere of what the different elements that they use, but it's like copper, iron, aluminum, all sorts of different stuff. So it's pretty cool. And so where we've seen liquid metal before, on the iPhones, you know those little keys that you use to pop out your SIM card?
Uh-huh.
That's liquid metal. Oh, man. Feels like liquid, doesn't it?
Okay, so what's special about it?
So what's special about it is essentially what it is it's a you know how so when you have ceramics like glass or like your ceramic plates and stuff, they have a special structure that makes them very strong and very stiff. That's why they shatter, but they've got a lot of strength and they're lightweight. Basically what they've done is they have a similar molecular structure of this metal as you would get with like an app or with a ceramic. And it's they call it, it's non-crystalline, so it doesn't have a regular pattern. It has a very jumbled up pattern, and what happens is but yet it's metal. So what happens is it's still conductive, and it still has the elasticity that metal has, you know, like when you get with springs and stuff. But okay, because it doesn't have a crystalline structure, it also has a tremendous amount of rigidity, which means that small things like scratches and wears and stuff, you know, metal will wear down because it's like sheets of metal and they just break off really cleanly. Whereas with it, you can't really sand down glass because of the structure, it just breaks up. Or resists that a lot more rather. So what they think is what this new metal, what it'll be made out of is, it'll be very resistant to scratches. It'll be really, really strong. Yet it'll have the flexibility to, you know, resist impact and stuff. It won't shatter. And then the other big thing is that that we're just learning about it is that you can mold it traditionally, like all of the aluminum that they make all of their computer cases out of. Those all have to be cut out and machined down. Right. You know, one of the big advantages and why most, you know, computers are made with plastic is because you can do injection molding, which is you have your really complex mold and you just shoot plastic, molten plastic into it, fills all the voids, and then you pop it out and you've got this like perfect case. It's really fast, it's really cheap, it doesn't waste much material. Well, one of the things about this metal is that unlike other metals where you can't do injection molding because of how long it takes to cool and how it and a couple other properties of the metal, you can really, really easily do injection molding with this metal. And so you'll have these, they'll basically be able to create a really, really highly sophisticated piece of metal very quickly. It'll look great, it'll be really strong. So you know, so if you were wondering what the iPhone 5 was going to be, that's pretty much it.
You think it'll be ready by the 5?
Yeah, everybody that, you know, they started talking about it back before the 4. They actually, that was when they first started talking about it, so I think that they've, you know, in the first keys that were made with liquid metal came out with the 3G. You know, so it's, they've been working on it for 4 years. They've been talking about it being incorporated into the body of the phone for 2 years. You know, if it's not ready yet, I don't think it'll ever be ready. You know?
So I wonder what I know the reason why they use the glass back is for antenna stuff. Or at least I thought that was why.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
Yeah, that's what they've always claimed that. So I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do about that. That is one big question because, yeah, that's what they claimed. Of course, you know, they built the antenna to the outside of the phone with the 4. You know, maybe you'll have a similar ring of metal that will be separated by, you know, some sort of a plastic space, or, you know, sort of like the divisions in the antenna currently. You know, and maybe that's just the plan, is that it'll have small, you know, really thin black strips that actually insulate each piece of metal from each other. But everybody seems pretty sure that they're going the liquid metal route. So.
Okay. Yeah. Good luck with that.
Definitely.
We'll see. I like the glass look. I'd be okay if they kept with that.
Yeah.
But that's just me.
Cool.
So what's Phillips been up to?
Oh, that's right. So the Beeb, BBC, talking. Phillips invented a new light bulb. And it was it looks, where did I just, which department was it? I think it was the Department of Energy basically said, you know, because they ban incandescent light bulbs before they lift the ban for incandescent light bulbs. And the thing that everybody was saying was, you know, the replacement were going to be all of your halogen light bulbs, and the problem is that, you know, they're actually toxic if they break. They're terrible for manufacturing from an environmental perspective. People die, get mercury poisoning. The light is not very natural. It's kind of awful. They're expensive, and they don't actually save you any energy unless you turn them on and leave them on. If you're flipping them on and off, they're no more efficient, and they don't last any longer than incandescent light bulbs. So essentially, what they realized was, if you really want to move America off of the incandescent light bulbs, you have to have a better light bulb. So the Department of Energy basically said, we're gonna make a challenge, and we're gonna have a bunch of money ready for somebody who can make a light bulb that lasts a long time under normal operating conditions and produces the soft, natural light glow of incandescent light bulbs. Let's make an actual light bulb replacement, something that is good, and hopefully is affordable, and then go from there. So Philips introduced they won the competition. They introduced the new light bulb on
Earth Day. It also says that they were the only ones to enter the competition.
Oh, does it?
So good job, guys.
Yeah, congratulations. But it's basically, it's an LED a light bulb. So those are really efficient, and they do last a long time under normal operating conditions, which is
20 years.
Yeah, 20 years. Pretty big deal. That's pretty awesome. They cost $60, which is, you know, kind of ridiculous.
That's awesome.
Except that they last 20 years. So you could, you know, if you're willing to make kind of a bigger investment, you will, like, literally never have to replace your light bulbs, which is cool.
Wow.
And it gives the natural light. And it looks like all they're doing is they basically have filters that the light shines through that gives it the soft glow. And the other nice part about LEDs is that you have to do some – the dimmers on halogen light bulbs don't work as well. They don't work properly.
The CFLs.
Oh, the CFLs, sorry.
They don't dim at all. It's either on or off. Those are your choices.
Right, and so you have to do basically pulse width modulation in order to dim them, and that circuitry is really expensive. Whereas LEDs do dim based on just lowering the voltage, and that you can do with a potentiometer, which is how traditional light bulb dimmers work. So
a dimmer switch.
Yeah, thank you.
For those non-engineers out there.
Yeah, exactly. So these actually act like, it looks like these are actual light bulb replacements, which is pretty cool. Kind of expensive, but you know, I'm sure between the energy that you would save over a 20-year period, and the fact that they last 20 years, it sounds like they're actually a not only do they do what they're supposed to do, but it looks like they're actually a good investment. So that's always what you're looking for with those sorts of technological innovations.
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing, too, where, I mean, honestly, you should probably wait another year or two before buying them.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, especially as we get closer to 2014, where all these things become banned in the U.S.,
yeah,
you're going to see a lot more investment poured into it and a lot more sales and deals. And you're going to see them reach around, like, $20
right.
each. You know, so it'll be $1 a year, and that'll be worth it.
Yeah, definitely.
I know we're slowly but surely switching all of our stuff over to CFLs for now.
Yeah.
And, you know, we just, you know, as a bulb burns out, we'll switch it up. No big deal. I don't know if I noticed any difference in my energy bills, but, you know.
Yeah.
Counts.
Hey, man, it's important to take those steps. As somebody who works in the semiconductor industry, I can't tell you how exciting it is to think that every light bulb would be made with LEDs. that'd be pretty cool. So, we'll see.
Yeah, it'll get there. So, our last story for the day is Apple versus Google, lessons from Bill Gates' playbook. So, this was the story that I was talking about how awesome Microsoft is.
All right.
And I'll warn you now, it makes Apple look pretty good and Google not so good. but that's all predicated on how you interpret Microsoft's actions. So
right.
We'll go with that. Let's see here. This guy says, for those too young to remember, Microsoft has had a run like no other. Through a combination of strategic brilliance, relentless focus, and sheer determination, Microsoft leveraged its initial DOS beachhead into a PC industry crushing market share and massive profits vis-a-vis Windows, Office, Internet Explorer, and BackOffice, a position cemented by a uniform foundation of developer tools and legions of dedicated Microsoft developers. When Microsoft set its sights on a market, it would squeeze the life out of the market leader like an anaconda wrapping itself around its prey. Before it was done, the company struck numerous segments, including personal computing, spreadsheets, databases, networking, and internet browsers. It's not hyperbole to say that Apple's Phoenix-like rise and Google's ascent are directly and positively correlated with Gates's decision to step away from running his company as CEO in 2000.
Wow, interesting.
So that's the intro. And then he goes on.
This guy's clearly a Microsoft fanboy.
He's a Bill Gates fanboy, which
I don't know.
And then he goes on to talk about seven things that Microsoft did, and then says, like, okay, you know, of the two of them, you know, between Apple and Google, which was copying their strategy. And his whole point is saying, like, all right, they're coming from two fundamentally different strategies, and they've each derived their own truths from Microsoft. And basically he's saying that Google has decided to say whatever Microsoft did was horrible, we're going to do the opposite, and Apple is now embracing what Microsoft did in its own way. And both are being successful, honestly. But so the first one was an integrated strategy. I know it sounds crazy, but one of the reasons why Microsoft was able to dominate their segment was because they were able to leverage a lot of their like sibling APIs or common APIs and developer tools. So like the example would be they would be able to go into a market and pretty much like a database, say market, and then create a database that looked exactly like the leading competitor, and then say, oh yeah, and we threw in our regular data, our API tool, so that you can connect it to Word and Excel and PowerPoint and, you know, all of our networking stuff. And now all of a sudden, Microsoft Access database is like infinitely better than the competitor, even though it looks exactly the same, because it's integrated with all this other stuff.
Right.
And so they just crushed, right? I mean, you think about what they do with Internet Explorer, right? Oh, it's got hardware acceleration because it's ours.
Yeah. Well, that was nice of them.
Yeah, and now they say, and that's exactly what Apple is doing.
Right.
iTunes, iOS, iCloud, they're all like doing it. Whereas Google, they said, nah, it's all loosely coupled together. There's no like, it's not integration like you now see Apple and what Microsoft used to be.
Right.
For sure. Platform hegemony? Homogeneity? I don't know.
Wait.
Homogeneity?
It's you really threw me off with the hegemony, because hegemony is a different thing. It has to do with you know, countries overruling other countries. Homogeny is,
which would be cooler, actually.
Yes, actually, quite a bit. So this is basically saying all the platforms are the same.
Well, okay, all right. Don't steal my thunder.
I'm sorry. Greek stole your thunder. That's or Latin rather.
Nice. So another reason why Microsoft became dominant was because they were able to say, like, PC became known as, like, Windows, Office, and, you know, Office Docs and stuff like that.
Right.
And, you know, didn't matter if it was made by HP or Dell or Toshiba. And, you know, and so they were like, it all meant Microsoft. And Apple's trying to do the same thing, right? Apple, iPad, iOS, and the SDK. You know, they're all, it's all one thing is what they're trying to make it, you know. And whereas Android, it's very fragmented, as we've talked about many times. You know, they've said, no, we're not going to, you know, be top-down control of everything.
Right.
So once again, it's like Apple's saying, oh, we're going to try the Microsoft approach, and Google's saying, and we're going to do the exact opposite approach. which is fine. You know, so like developers, Microsoft was always into their developers, or, you know, when Gates was around, it was always into developers. And like Apple is now, they created the tools that they needed to succeed. They put the economics in place so that they could actually make money. And they had marketing programs and sales channels. Oh, I just killed a fly in the air. That was awesome.
Nice.
So they put all these things in place to help people be successful. And like Apple is totally all over developers now, which is, you know, which is cool. And Google is still more of a, yeah, we like developers. You know, we think you're good. It's more talk than action, I guess, at this point in time. You know, and they're just like, hey, it's free. You know, that's cool, right? And
yeah,
it's unfortunately not quite good enough. Another one that they talk about is waste transistors. I guess the Intel CEO, Andy Grove, he once quipped that as quickly as they could find new ways to add transistors, Bill Gates found a way to use them. And but it comes to this, there was this tight integration between hardware and software, is basically what he's saying.
Yeah.
And, you know, which I sounds kind of weird to say that, but, you know, because you think about, like, it had a whole bunch of different hardware, but, like, the guts of it, and, you know, Windows itself really tried to, you know, be close together. And that's, yeah, you know, what Apple's really going after, too, and, you know, trying to be super tight and take advantage. You know, if they put something in the phone, it's because they intend to use it.
Right, whereas like the Tegra 2 by NVIDIA right now, which is the best mobile processor for, you know, phones and stuff, from a strict hardware perspective, its overall performance in the phones on Android phones is awful compared to Apple, and the reason is entirely because of wasted hardware. You know, Android doesn't utilize
Google's fault. It's more of, what happens is Google lets the hardware manufacturers and carriers customize it however they want, as opposed to what Microsoft did, which was say, hey, we have standards, and you have to hit these compatibility standards. Otherwise, we're not letting you make it. And right. And Google doesn't do that at all.
Yeah.
They let it be free, open, and wild. Mm. Number five was commoditization, which is actually what I thought the homogenization was. which is probably why I said it that way. And it is this idea that that one's dumb. Next one, love all segments. and this one's actually one where Google and Apple flip. Pretty much Microsoft, when they made something, they were like, dude, we make it for anybody and everybody. Whoever wants to use it, no big deal. You know, they didn't really have – there was no product category that they didn't like.
Right.
And Google's kind of the same way. You know, dude, use the phones for anything. Who cares? We love it all. It's amazing. Whereas Apple tends to be very much like, no. This is designed for this segment. Think about, like, the iPod Touch, right? All of a sudden, yeah, they noticed that people were starting to play games on it. They went, it's a gaming device now. Get over it. That's it now. That's what it
right.
is. That's what we're yeah. calling it. It's not a productivity tool. That's not what this is. It's a gaming device.
Right, which is ridiculous for all the people out there like me who use it as a productivity tool and play games occasionally on the side.
Which you can do, but that is not how they think about it. And
right.
that's not how they talk about their sales on it at all.
Yeah.
It's 100% consumer device, for sure.
Right.
That's the assumption that they make and are shocked when they see stuff in the office.
Right.
Would be my guess. Whereas Google's like, cool, you know, yeah, whatever, it's there. We don't care. It's a sale. Sale is a sale is a sale.
Yeah.
And then the last one was for the win. It says here, someone once compared Microsoft to a football dynasty who week after week would so thoroughly blow out the competition that it was embarrassing to all parties involved. Microsoft just couldn't resist running up the score.
Right.
That's awesome. I love that. That visual. And that was so, like, that was Bill Gates, right? Just, like, he's super aggressive, wanted to – he didn't just want to win, you know?
Right.
He wanted you to never want to play against him again. And, you know, and it's funny in that regard, it kind of reminds you of Steve Jobs.
Yeah, yeah.
Later in life, I'm going to go thermonuclear on Google.
Right.
I don't care if I spend every last penny of my company's money to kill them. That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
You know, similar thing. Whereas Google tends to be a little more collegial. You know, I mean, unless it comes to Oracle, in which case they're going to fight for their rights. But, you know, and their whole thing is like, it's okay to have a small project, and it's okay if you fail. And, you know, it's all about letting the thousand flowers bloom and just see where it goes.
Right.
So the question is, you know, is the Microsoft analogy that we've kind of looked at and the way Microsoft did it, is that the right way for winning in the post-PC market?
Yeah.
You know, or is Google doing the right thing by saying, no, you know what, that made sense when... you know, then,
yeah.
And then this new world of the cloud, it doesn't make sense. You need to be nice and you need to be open and you need to be flexible about things.
You know, I think in the realm of the crowd, I think they're right. I think in hardware, I think they're wrong. and my example is, you know, it's NVIDIA hates developing for, well, I can't say they hate developing, but are frustrated by the fact that, that they get such low performance on the final product, and it's because Google doesn't, where they do keep tight standards, they do it poorly, and where they don't keep tight standards, they're used wrong. And I think what you're seeing again and again and again, especially by the fact that, you know, the iPhone consistently gets better, you know, better marks than the Android phones from, you know, whenever they're compared. And I think you're really seeing the side effect of that. And, you know, it's hard to argue against numbers. You know, obviously Android's selling like crazy. But at the same time, the profit share is, you know, unbelievably in Apple's favor. And if
which really if the means difference between, theoretically that Apple will be able to afford to continue to invest and do research and development and make their product better over time. And Google is going to have to continue to rely on their search engine revenue to do that. And if that ever fell off, or if they decided to, they won't be able to pursue something else either, because that they have a finite amount of money to play with. You know, whereas Apple could define a new category, say the iPad, and go, hey, cool, we also conveniently created a new revenue stream to continue development on it. You know, whereas Google keeps creating these new business divisions, but no new revenue, meaningful revenue stream to go with it to continue the innovation and the improvement. And, you know, I guess as long as they got billions of dollars and, you know, search is doing fine, great, but eventually you're going to hit a cap.
Right.
And you got to make some tough choices, which, I mean, they're kind of doing, right, by all the streamlining that they're doing, because these things don't make money. They're like, dude, we got to make choices here. We're spread too thin. Whereas if each of those were making money and self-sustained, they'd be like, whatever, we'll keep it. Doesn't matter. You know, we'll just keep iterating it because they're self-sufficient, self-sustaining. You think about General Electric, right? They got how many divisions and how many different business units? I mean, it's got to be hundreds. They got a lot of products at least, and a lot of different divisions, right? I mean, they make jet engines is one of their thing, along with toothpaste. I mean, it's unbelievable. But each division is independently successful and self-sustaining. So like, dude, doesn't matter. Well, you know, we'll make it its own group, its own business unit, let it do its thing, and as long as they're making money, we don't care.
Right.
And, you know, and so they can afford to get bigger and bigger and bigger and become a behemoth, whereas I think Google still has to figure that one out.
Right.
And then, and that's the business model, honestly. You know, you can talk about your process and the way that you do it, but yeah, at the end of the day, if you're not making money and you're not self-sustainable, you have a limited potential for awesomeness.
Yeah, and it's funny, I've talked to a lot of people who want to work for Google, and you always ask, well, what do you want to do at Google? You know what I've noticed nobody ever says? Nobody ever says, I want to work on the search engine algorithm, which I think is an interesting commentary on the nature of what Google's doing in their approach. You know, it's like their one true revenue stream is not the technology that gets anybody excited. It's not the technology that's bringing in the best and the brightest and the most enthusiastic. And yet, like you said, everything hinges on that for them. And that's kind of terrifying, you know, from an outsider's perspective, at least. You know, it's just
They're okay for now. I mean,
it
is a cash machine. I mean, let's not
that. It prints money, but yes. You know, I don't know. I think they put a bunch of eggs in this basket, and if they, you know, like you said,
I don't necessarily want to say they put a bunch of eggs in their basket, but it's just they've made the choice not to pursue revenue on their other projects.
Right.
And they've been very blessed to have one huge revenue waterfall.
It's not right.
Even, you know, torrent. So, you know, so they don't have to, I mean, so they're not forced to it. And I think in some ways, actually, as a result of that, they're uncomfortable with charging for things because they weren't forced to at the beginning. And they weren't forced to get over that. And so that feels weird to them. Whereas, you know, companies like Apple and Microsoft are like, that's what they did from the very onset. You know, they charge for their computers and for their software. And they're like, this is what we do. This is how you make money. Trust us. We've been doing it since day one. Right. You know, that was how they did it. They didn't have this whole like giving stuff away for free. You know, it's like iCloud, it's free. In some ways that to me, like Apple goes, this feels weird. We're just going to give this away. Do you know how many hours we spent on this, and we're just going to give it away?
Yeah.
You know, and that's their thought. And, you know, whereas with Google, it'd be like, we're going to charge someone for this. Can you believe that? This is nuts. Someone's going to pay us money. No way.
Which is ironic because it, you know, goes back to that other conversation we had earlier tonight about, you know, if you're growing, you're losing money, or if you're sustaining, you're losing money.
Yeah.
If you're growing, you're losing more money, and if you're exploding, you're losing tons of money. You know, and that's where they are with Android right now. It's such a, you know, they the only reason why they think they're making money with Android is because of ads due to their searching. It's like, that's how they come up with this is how we're making money. You know, there's the X many more, you know, searches done because of Android, which is an interesting way to look at a platform. You know, obviously it's something that it's working for them, but it is, you know, in stark contrast to the more traditionals. This is how much we make on this platform because this is how much money we make when people pay for it.
And they're playing the same game that HP played with their printers, where they're going to sell them at a loss and we'll make it back on ink or toner.
Right.
And, you know, and so they're saying we're going to sell our phones at a loss or, you know, break even and, or, you know, give our software away, whatever. It's at a loss if you include the human components of developer time. Right. But we'll make it back up on searches because people will be able to do that more often. You know, and I get that. That's a legit business model.
Definitely.
That works. You hear about it, you know, game consoles, they'll sell them at a loss for a while and make it back up on games.
Right.
That's totally, totally valid. I think theirs is a little extreme, personally. You'd like to at least see them breaking even, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
All right, dude.
What are you going to do?
Anything? Yeah. Anything else going on in your life?
Oh, nothing extraordinary, actually. Kind of a slow week.
Cool. Me too, other than a big sunburn.
Yeah.
I'm sure it'll be a big sunburn.
Yeah.
All right, man. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. I am James Furlow, and my brother is Matthew Furlow, and we will talk next time. I'll give you the secret sign for when you need to unmake your thing, go to sleep again.
What is that?
What?
What's the secret sign?
It's a secret. If okay. I told you it, it wouldn't be a secret.
Sounds good. Cool. You ready?
Wait. Yes.
Okay.
Wait, no.
Oh, jeez. Oh, man, that hurt. That one hurt.
Okay, now I'm ready.
Okay.